Oh, good morning. I'm Michael Cathcart, and a very big welcome to Bush Telegraph here on ABC Radio National, where we're looking at some of Australia's iconic animals all this week here on Radio National Summer. Now, this fella isn't on the coat of arms, but I bet you'll find him on your bookshelf.
I'm Blinky Bill. My whole life's a thrill. I do exactly what I like. I'm Blinky Bill.
Yes, indeed, Blinky Bill. And if you don't have a copy of Blinky Bill, well, you've probably got a copy of The Magic Pudding, which stars Bunyip Bluegum, whose heart wouldn't melt at the sight of a koala, which is an excellent reason to dedicate the entire show to the life and times of this furry little creature. We broadcast this program in May, and there was an expectation that the Federal Government Senate Committee looking into the status, health and sustainability of koalas all across Australia would have completed the report by now. But the Federal Environment Minister Tony Burke has deferred that decision, so we'll have to wait until the 17th of February when we'll all find out if the koala is going to be added to the list of nationally threatened species. Well, how secure is the future of Blinky Bill? Australia's koala woman, Deborah Tabard, is campaigning for the cause, and she's joined us on the line from Washington. What's she doing there?
Well, I'm talking to American lawyers about writing a National Koala Act because I think that's the next logical step to protect the koalas. And I've suggested that in the Senate inquiry, and I've been talking to American lawyers on and off for the last 11 years. So we'll get there eventually.
Well, we should explain that the Senate is holding an inquiry. In a minute, we'll speak to Senator Mary Jane Fisher, who's chair of the committee that's holding that inquiry. Deborah, you've been, in one way or another, involved in this cause for about 25 years.
I have. And, yes, and in fact, I think the feelings I had after being in Canberra recently at the Senate inquiry made me feel like there's a bit of a light at the tunnel at the moment. I think the koala people who have been presenting their data, including us, have really made a compelling case that the koala's in trouble.
Now, just before you came on, we were playing this sound, which you'll recognise as a koala. What on earth is going on when a koala makes this extraordinary noise?
Well, I've had to learn how to use that noise over the years, but that's a boy, and he's just saying, "This is my territory, and, you know, come hither if you're a girl, and get lost if you're another boy." So it's all about...
It's complex, isn't it? There are two things. Bugger off, she's mine, he's saying, basically.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, in fact, I was with Cornell University once when they were recording a male, you know, doing that, and then this little dear little girl sort of flapping her ears and making this sort of, "Yes, yes, I'll come." And then an old girl called Scarlett went, "Ah." So I think she was remembering years past, dear old Scarlett. And I do chat to Scarlett occasionally at Lone Pine. So they're, unlike the scientific literature, which sort of doesn't want to, put personalities on to them, I hate to say it that I do know a lot of koalas' personalities, and indeed I can even sort of see familial tendencies after 25 years. So my children think I should get a life sometime.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I was looking at Blinky Bill on Wikipedia just earlier, and Wikipedia describes Blinky Bill as an anthropomorphic koala, which I thought was a kind of joyless way of describing a character. Now, look, I gather that you've been inspired by the bald eagle story in the USA. How does this work, Deb?
Well, one of the lawyers that I'm talking to and I met with today, he came out in the year 2000 and evaluated for us all the legislation in Australia to see whether or not it's capable of protecting the koalas. And I think they looked at 23 pieces and none of it works. So they told me about the Bald Eagle Act, which was brought in when the eagle was in trouble. And basically it worked so effectively that the eagle is now off the list. So I just see that as this is the iconic species of the United States. The United States government has actually listed the koala as an endangered species under their legislation, which is possible under theirs. And I've argued strongly for the last 11 years that the Australian government should have followed suit, and they haven't.
Now, the states do have protections, though, don't they? I mean, our states, yes. The Australian states.
They do. But if that, as I've argued to the senators, if they worked, how come we've seen 25,000 dead koalas in southeast Queensland alone? That is actually documented on a government website. So I'm arguing those legislations don't work. I'm arguing that in New South Wales, for things like coal seam gas or coal mining, the legislation is extinguished during the exploration phases.
Mm.
So what's the point in having laws if people aren't going to meet them?
Well, Deborah, you're going to stay with us right through the show, so there's lots to talk through. But stay with me now as we talk about the Senate committee, which is looking into the status, the health and the sustainability of Australia's koala population. This is the first time that the vulnerability of the koala has been examined at a national level, and the committee will set out the guidelines for the protection of the animal. It's about to present its final report, or it's yet to present its final report. Submissions have been rolling in. And we're joined now by the chair of the Environment and Communications References Committee, Liberal Senator Mary Jo Fisher, who's kindly stepped out.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Deb.
Nice to have you with us. Thank you for stepping out of the party room to join us for this. So what exactly is the committee looking at, Senator?
Essentially, the sustainability of our wonderful koalas and whether there is anything more we can do to help.
So the idea is to list the animal under the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, is that right?
Well, that is the idea of lots of those who've given evidence to the committee. It's not necessarily the idea of everybody who's given evidence to the committee. We've had 2 days of hearing so far, Michael, and we've got another one coming up in Melbourne, and that'll be our last day of hearing, following which the committee will do a report. You talked about consideration of the welfare of the koala at a national level. It has been considered at a national level before, although I suspect this may well be the first time that a Senate committee has looked at it, but it has been considered often at a national level. There's this thing called a scientific committee made up of experts, and they make recommendations to the government of the day about whether or not a particular animal or species is able or appropriately able to be, unfortunately, listed as vulnerable,
right,
or about to become extinct under the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Act. So that committee has considered the koala 3 times in, I think, the last 10 years, and each time decided, no, at this stage, the koala cannot be so listed. Many of the witnesses to the inquiry want it to be so listed.
Now, Senator, keeping on your impartial hat as chair of the committee, can you summarise some of the positions that have been put to you? I mean, are there, for example, people who are arguing against listing?
There are people who are concerned about the consequences of listing. For example, obviously those involved in property development, because one of the consequences of listing, if a species is listed, it means that there's conservation advice that gets developed, a register of critical habitat, so where, in this case, the koala is entitled to live, if you like, as of right, there would be recognition of key threats, development and recognition of things that threaten the koala. There'd be measures put in place to minimise those threats. Now, all things that make sense if it is able to be done. Now, obviously, the flip side of that, given that some of the threats to koalas are cars, dogs, and urban development or property development, if the koala were to be listed, then you could expect perhaps some limitations in respect of the use of cars, in respect of dogs, not just domestic dogs, but feral dogs or wild dogs. You could also expect limitations on the activities, for example, of property developers. So there are bodies who've expressed concerns. I'm not sure, I stand to be corrected, I'm not sure that anyone has said outright, we oppose this. I don't think anyone has said that. We all love the koala. I don't think that's debatable. And many of the witnesses we've had to the committee have told us wonderful and very endearing stories. Their passion is beyond question, and commitment to the koala.
It sounds like a terrific case, because I'm hearing in your voice that this isn't a bitter political issue, and it's bringing to the surface some pretty fundamental questions about how we live in this country.
It is, and it's about a balance. We would all do this if we would do this if we could, and I think that's part of what successive governments, not just Liberal governments, but the now Labor government, has struggled with. The evidence is patchy. The evidence is we actually don't know how many koalas are out there. We don't know where they live. We don't know how they live. Yes, Deb appropriately has referred to some koalas, who've been recorded as dying. But unless you have, who are dead, let me get rid of the jargon, unless you have a comprehensive map of where koalas live and are then able to map their populations, you don't know where you're starting from. We've got some really good demographic evidence in some regions. For example, southeastern Queensland and coastal New South Wales, there's really good data there. But then for the bioregions or some, you know, smaller areas, to put it into English, basically what people are saying about the population, it's based on anecdotes or opinions or extrapolated, and it gets really unreliable. And whilst we know, for example, or we think we know, well, we do know because New South Wales and Queensland, the data is better than other places, we can tell that, yes, koala populations have been going down in recent years, but some populations in southern Australia are increasing, so much so that we have to manage their habitat because they're overpopulating and basically destroying their own homes.
So, Senator, lots of factors for you to weigh up there. Well, thank you for joining us, Senator.
Thanks, Michael.
Liberal Senator Mary Jo Fisher there, who's chair of the Environment and Communications References Committee, looking into the future of the koala. Well, that's the future, but what about its past? Various Aboriginal groups have Dreamtime stories about the koala, of course, and they reveal a great deal about the unique physiology and habits of this elusive animal. The human population growth in southeast Queensland is putting tremendous pressure on koala habitat, and I guess that's one of the factors that'll be shaping the deliberations of the committee. Artist Michael Connolly lives at Redcliffe in this part of the world, and he draws on his Aboriginal heritage in his work at Kalula Arts, and he joins us now on ABC Radio National, where you're listening to Bush Telegraph. Good day, Michael. Tell us about your own background.
Well, my father was born in southwest Queensland from the coast about 1,100 kilometres to a place called Yulo, and that's on the Paroo River system, which runs down to the Darwin River system. And my mother was born in Gadigal, northwest New South Wales, and that's on the Culgo River, and that runs down into the Darwin River system as well. So we're sort of stretched from northwest New South Wales to far southwest Queensland.
You've got the whole country in your arms.
Just about, yeah. We're connected through into the desert as well, the southeast and Arundel, plus the Cooper River Basin, which runs down into South Australia.
You've got links with the whole nation. It's all running through your veins. How marvellous.
Yeah, love it too.
Now, one of the stories you tell is about Kubor. Is it Kubor the koala?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lovely painting that goes with this. Who was Kubor the koala?
It was actually a young orphan boy and part of the koala clan. And, he learned to live on the leaves of the gum tree because he never had enough water to quench his thirst. So, yeah, all these stories are based around sort of myths and legends of our people on how different animals and different plants became, you know.
Right, so, I mean, what happened? So, how did he use the leaves to quench his thirst?
Well, what happened was when his relatives wouldn't give him any water, he waited one more until they went away hunting, and then he gathered all the water buckets up and climbed the tree and put it up in the tree. And when they came back, they had no water, and they looked up and seen the buckets hanging in the tree. And he sang a song, and as he sang a song, the tree grew really, really, really tall, and so the old people couldn't get to the water. So then the spirit men, they managed to climb the tree, and they threw him out of the tree and smashed him on the ground. And what happened then, they were two clever men, which are spirit men and medicine men, and they climbed a tree and harshly beat and threw him to the ground, shattering his little body. And as the people watched, they witnessed the shattered body of Kubor change into a koala and climb into a nearby tree and sit on the top branches, where the koala sits today and doesn't need water to keep him alive. And Kubor then made a law that although the Aborigines may have killed him for food, that his skin must not be removed from his broken bones until after he is cooked, Should anyone disobey, the spirit of the dead koala will cause such a severe drought and everyone except the koalas will die of thirst.
Yeah, well, that'd teach you a lesson.
Yeah, and most of our dreaming stories are like that. You know,
yeah.
We grew up in the bush and, you know, Dad always told you, don't go there for this reason, don't touch that for this reason. And you always, you never ever question the old fellas. You always, you know, it was law, so you always done it, you know.
And Michael, what groups would share that story?
A lot of our dreaming stories are shared.
Yeah.
And because, see, what's happened over the years since the invasion is a lot of people have been separated from their country and their stories. So what's happened is they've had different people like Langlo Parker. She was one. There was three or four different anthropologists that went out and taped all the old fellas of the stories. So then when I got the tapes, they rewrote the stories into books. So a lot of our stories are generic, but probably told a little bit different areas, because some areas didn't have koalas and some didn't.
Yeah. So the anthropologists collected the stories, and then Indigenous people are kind of reclaiming them today.
Yeah, because see, a lot of our people have been really, like my father and mother, they were removed off their country, you know, in the early 1900s. So a lot, and they weren't allowed to speak language or tell stories. So a lot of them were hid away from their culture. So a lot of it was lost until lately that, you know, a lot of things out of the archives in Canberra and that, a lot of stories come through, a lot of people picking up different books and different types of stories, and now sort of it's come back to us.
Yeah.
In little bits and pieces, you know.
And Michael, as these stories re-enter the culture,
yeah,
thanks to the anthropologists who saved them, as you say, after the invasion, who do you think in the new way Australia's organised has, I don't know, cultural entitlement to tell these stories? Would you have to have Indigenous background, or do you think that, you know, it's a heritage for all Australians?
Well, I'm a cultural educator and also a cross-culture trainer, so I'd like a lot of people to learn to tell the stories and learn. There's heaps of books in now, thousands of books out, children's storybooks.
Yeah.
Put out where, you know, a lot of schools buy them and they read them to them, or they get an Aboriginal elder goes into the school and reads the way that he feels from his heart. Because as you know, unless you're part of that culture, the stories probably just mean like, it's like reading any story. But to an Aboriginal person reading the story and telling the children, it's a different feeling, a different way of presentation.
So in your mind, although there's clearly some cultural business that is still very secret and belongs to particular groups, there are now parts of culture that can be shared more widely, are there?
Oh, of course, mate. You know, it needs to be, mate, because, you know, the separation that, and, you know, I was talking to a lady the other day who didn't even know anything about the, you know, the poison water holes, the poison bread or anything, you know. So, you know, he's a woman in her 60s that knew nothing.
Yeah.
You know, about the way that our people were treated, you know, by King George IV, you know, from England.
In your area, over your lifetime, have you noticed anything about the koalas? Are there koalas living there?
Yeah, well, when I got home, especially like a good season we've had now in the west there, you know, they're everywhere. But the thing is, because a lot of the people have been pushing the trees over for cultivation and wood and that, you know, a lot of the koalas have sort of died out, you know.
Michael, thank you for joining us. It's been great to talk.
Thanks, Michael.
Michael Connolly there from Kalula Arts, and this is Bush Telegraph on ABC Radio National Summer. Yes, a happy koala there. We know that the koala once had a wide distribution throughout the eastern states of Australia, from far north Queensland swinging well down the east coast really and right down round to South Australia. So what's happened since 1788 when Europeans began to colonise this vast continent of ours? Anne Moyle is the author of Koala, a Historical Biography. It's a beautiful little book and it's published by CSIRO. And welcome to the program. Congratulations. It's a lovely publication.
Oh, thanks very much.
Now, the newcomers, this is an amazing fact, the newcomers, the Europeans, didn't really notice the koalas at first.
Well, there it is, the lovely little creature. It's tucked away in those very high trees, out of sight, completely inconspicuous unless you're peering up into the sky. And the explorers and white settlers, they really didn't notice it. And then it depended on Aboriginals to introduce two men quite early. That was about 1798 rather. There was one, John Price, who was led to them on the Cox's River, and another French lieutenant of Baralia. He was also led by Aborigines to some on the Nepean River. But though they jotted down information about it, their materials weren't published till late in the 19th century in historical records. So that news didn't break through. It was not till 1803 that Aboriginals brought some into settlement, and it was written up by the Lieutenant Governor, and the information sent off to Joseph Banks. But the really, what I find really interesting about the koala, it's these hidden stories which come out later. And a very important one was that the botanist and the natural history illustrator who travelled with Matthew Flinders on his investigator, they were left behind in 1803 when Matthew Flinders went off to look for a more seaworthy vessel. And one of them was Robert Brown, who was a botanist who became the most distinguished botanist in Britain in the 19th century, and he did a type specimen in Latin in that colony. Here he is writing in Latin, and a very fine description of the koala that comes. We only find it in the British Museum in this century, but the thing that is really remarkable and lives on, his natural history illustrator, the very famous Ferdinand Bauer, he did many beautiful depictions of the koala, which he took back to England and painted, and they were of his of a mother and child,
yes,
and also of the anatomical parts, all very exact, very beautiful. It's on the cover of my book.
It is. Well, and you've got some lovely illustrations in the book. I mean, some early ones of artists who really couldn't quite take in what they were seeing. There's a picture there of a koala walking on all fours as if it's a kind of tiger.
Oh, well, yes, I think that's a Cuvier one that was drawn in Europe. But the man whose painting did get out in 1803 was John Lewin, and he did not a terribly accurate one of a mother with a baby on her back. That was sent off to Joseph Banks, and that picture flowed into and informed Europeans about the koala.
Yes, there are versions of that picture all over the place, aren't there? The one picture becomes a kind of standard. Now, the strangeness of the animal really didn't play into the koala's favour. I mean, now we think of the animal as cute and furry and cuddly, and we can't imagine people thinking of it any other way, but that's really not the way it was thought of in the 19th century.
Well, the British had a great disdain for the quaint Australian fauna. They thought of them as rather like the convicts, as if it was a sort of faunal gulag. And when this charming animal, the koala, reached England, it was described by one very prominent editor, a naturalist editor of a journal called Arcana. His name was Perry. And he described it as a senseless, torpid creature and could hardly understand what usefulness in the scale of usefulness or happiness such an animal could be created by God.
Well, of
so
course,
that was a prevailing view.
It was, and one of the uses to which the settlers put it was fur. Tell us about the Great Slaughter of 1927.
Well, it's a terrible story about the koala. Almost from 1840 on, when settlers and squatters began to move out across the country, and the trees were being ring-barked, and the areas of large populations of koalas were being destroyed. Of course, and when the gold fields were being settled, diggers were travelling around. Suddenly, the magic of the koala fur bore home to these men, and they began to trap it and to shoot it in enormous quantities. And it's a terrible story. I can almost not bear reading about some of the accounts about how they would trap them at the bottom of the tree. And there was one account, which I always have to tell because it's so ghastly, and that was of a koala who was poisoned by stuff they left at the bottom of the tree. They then got the koala. They totally skinned it, and the koala began to climb up the tree without any fur. And the stories are hair-raising. The numbers are even more hair-raising. There's something like they run into hundreds of thousands very quickly. In New South Wales is the worst place, and in Queensland. And by about 1924, there was something like a million koalas had been exported. They were brought down to Sydney from all parts, and no laws were really introduced to protect them. And such laws that were introduced only gave a sort of a season when they were protected. So the massacres were absolutely formidable, and the worst of them was in Queensland in 1927. And it was by that time the estimate that some 200 million koala skins had been exported, both to Britain and the United States.
You've got an extraordinary photo in your book of some blokes standing on a wagon, just piled high with koala pelts. It's quite shocking.
Yes, that was something like 300. I can't remember exactly how many that number was. But by 1927, a million koalas had been slaughtered. And it was the most attractive skin. It was the warmest, and it could be made into a very excellent leather. It was often exported under the name of wombat, just to protect the records such as they were. And it was almost extinguished in some parts. And it was only then that the public began to raise an angry cry about it and to take an interest. Then no one had really bothered very much about what was happening. The wilderness societies had made murmur. None of the 19th century scientists ever talked about this destruction, except Gould, who predicted that Australians hadn't got a real sense of the marvellousness of their animals and that they did face a possible extinction. But it was the worst part of the story. And it's only when this great massacre occurred in Queensland that the decision was made to introduce a law there. And then the people in general began to take an interest in this animal. And
around the 1930s, things changed. Let's pick up that story a little later in our conversation, Anne. Anne Moyle is my guest here on Bush Telegraph, as we devote the entire program to the koala, and we'll hear her a little bit later on as we continue our conversation. And listening to the magic pudding is Helen Glad, who is Norman Lindsay's granddaughter. Helen, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Michael.
The magic pudding's had a fair old life. It really does live on, doesn't it?
Well, he's not called Albert Cut and Come Again for nothing. He certainly gets used by various people. You know, the economy's called the magic pudding, but it's such a wonderful story and full of lovely illustrations, as you say.
I actually find it a bit creepy, to be perfectly frank with you. These two friends who've got this friend who they eat a lot of and then who gets stolen, even though there's plenty for everybody, I find it a bit alarming.
Do you?
I do. I know I'm odd like this, but when did Norman Lindsay's infatuation with the koala start? Because, of course, Bunyip Bluegum is one of the wonderful representations of koalas.
Well, it started really about 10 years earlier in a magazine called The Lone Hand, which appeared monthly. It was published by J.F. Archibald, and it was a fantastic magazine full of stories and articles about Australia, you know, Australia's new nationhood.
It was a sort of spin-off of the Bulletin, really, wasn't it, The Lone
Hand?
It
was, but it was a much more, a kind of meaty, and because it was monthly, they had longer articles and stories. And Norman started drawing Billy Bluegum, not Bunyip Bluegum, and Billy Bluegum, the koala, appears in all kinds of guises, as a boxer, as a, you know, politician, making election speeches, and they're actually, I believe, the first sort of comic strips drawn in Australia in about 1907.
And can you identify the qualities in Lindsay's drawings that really strike a chord with us, which make these koalas seem so, well, familiar?
I think the secret is that they're real koalas. Instead of, they're not like cartoon characters. They're actually, you can imagine a koala wearing a boater and striped pants. They're really, and that's true of all of Lindsay's drawings of native animals. They're real animals. They're just not cartoon characters. He was I imagine, drawing from life.
I wonder, though, whether the shape of the face has something to do with the way we particularly identify with koalas.
Well, it's easier, in fact, when you think about it. The koala's ears are in the right spot and about the right size, particularly for a boxer. And when they're standing up, it's much easier to draw a dress a koala than it would be a kangaroo with a large tail and big feet.
Now, listening into our conversation is Deb Tabbart, who's been with us all along, the koala woman. Deb, when did you first encounter the magic pudding?
Oh, as a child, and so I just loved hearing that. In fact, I've loved the whole show so far, Michael, because I often say Mum and Dad must have done a good job on me as a child. So Blinky Bill, Dorothy Wall, Mary Gibbs, all those things were my bread and butter as a child, and we used to sing and read C.J. Dennis poems, so I think it's the koalas in my heart.
And of course these images of koalas really do affect the way in which a rising generation of Australians, you know, you get them when they're children, and they think of koalas as people that they can relate to. I guess this changes their attitude to conservation.
Well, I think Norman was pretty special, you know. In fact, one of the last drawings he ever did of himself was actually as a koala. Helen probably knows that. It's in one of a book called Norman's Bears. And the way I have interpreted this is that I think he realised we were not the British lion. I think he realised the koala was special. And when you look at how he used those koalas to speak out against wars and you know, use it as satire, I think the koalas was very important to Norman Lindsay, and it's certainly important to the psyche of Australians.
Helen, can you come in on that? Because there is a lot of self-questioning in that period after the First World War about what it means to be Australian. How does the magic pudding reflect Lindsay's take on this?
Well, I think both the magic pudding and Snuggle Pot and Cuddle Pie, in fact, appeared in 1918 at a time when Australia had gone through some pretty horrible times and death and destruction all around. And they were a wonderful escape from that, I think, in lots of ways. Norman had been one of the artists that drew some of the programs and invitations for Federation. So he was very involved in this new nation. And during the First World War, he was, in fact, probably anti-Hun more than anti-war, because a lot of the drawings he did, the koalas at that time, were in fact to encourage people to join up. And he often, you see a couple of koalas dressed as,
yes,
Anzacs.
Yes, that's true. Anne Moyle's also with us. We've been talking to Anne. Anne's the author of Koala, this lovely book published by CSIRO. How do you see this phase in Lindsay's life, Anne?
Well, I think it was enormously important. He discovered the koala really a bit before The Lone Hand. He'd done a few cartoons for The Bulletin. And about before the war, he'd begun to think of writing a story, as he'd been so enamoured of the creature. And he thought about it. He wrote to his to the publisher at Angus and Robertson's. And he felt that... One, he really was writing for children. He felt it was a time that the relief was needed. And he knew that, on your point of feeling it's a very spooky book, he wrote it because he knew children loved reading about food. And so the magic pudding could be eaten as a beef pudding, or it could be eaten as a jam and roly pudding and all these things.
Yes, he'll just become whatever food you want to eat, the magic pudding becomes.
Would produce it, yes. And but I think that what he was, why he was influenced and used the koala so successfully in the magic pudding, was to convey the sort of ideals about the Australian that were coming out from the war, a sense of mateship and comradeship and egalitarian virtues. And he was also very strong on justice. And these are all the qualities that come out from those conversations.
Well, I suppose Anne, but it doesn't say much for possums, because the possums in the Book of the Thieves.
Oh, well, of course, you've got to deal with that sort of thing, Michael. Life's like that. It's not easy. If you've got a hero, you've got to stick with them.
It's complex.
They have fights among themselves, though.
That's right. So Norman Lindsay, of course, isn't the only artist to embrace the koala. We start to see this appearing in other books through the 20th century. Ed.
Oh, yes. Well, that's true. Of course, what happened from Norman, I had a lovely moment when I was researching this. I was given permission by the head of the Taronga Zoo to go and see a koala sitting there to be a koala. And the keeper introduced me to this steel grey koala, very mild, and told me his name was Norman. And I said, it's a very odd name to give to a koala. They're usually Billy Blue Gum or something. He said very gravely, I called him after Norman Lindsay because he did so much for conservation. But it was Norman Lindsay who set in train this popular view of this animal. They began to the first stamp about a koala with a koala on it was produced in 1930, and after that the press took up the popularization of the koala, using children in cartoons and things to try and preserve it. So it all, the 30s was a very crucial time when Australians really began to feel themselves as Australians and with a particular animal. As it was rightly said, it was not a lion and it was a koala. But
yes.
From then on, we never looked back, because I think the first fluffy toy of a koala was introduced in the early 30s. And, of course, the monumental amount of items produced with a koala on it, well, you couldn't count it.
You couldn't count them at all. Now, this is Bush Telly on ABC Radio. Actually, we're talking about koalas. We've been talking to all sorts of people. Helen Glad's been with us. Helen's the granddaughter of Norman Lindsay. Helen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Been terrific to talk to you. Also with us is science historian Anne Moyle and koala activist Deb Tabbart. Now, Deb, we're going to play a song by John Williamson called Goodbye Blinky Bill. Of course, Blinky Bill is one of the characters who appears in the 1930s, drawn by Dorothy Wall and hugely popular. Now, there's a background to the song Goodbye Blinky Bill. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, John Williamson wrote that song and passed around the hat to raise money for the little hospital in Port Macquarie. And I think he is still a great supporter of that. And when I first started my job years ago, the hospital, you know, I visited there, and seeing sick and injured animals is one of the saddest things you can do. And that's why I feel like I'm better in the halls of politics and lawyers and things. I don't think I could bear to see koalas ripped apart by dogs and dying every day.
This was in the 1980s, and koalas at that time were particularly threatened by the disease chlamydia.
Yes. Well, the chlamydia, there's no question that's still, you know, rearing its head. But what we said to the Senate, and I would like to make the point that the Australian Koala Foundation believes there's no more than 80,000 koalas, probably more likely 40,000 left, and we do believe we know where they are. So, and I think that if we don't stop cutting down the trees, we will never get to the problems of disease. So when you're starving to death, you're being ripped apart by dogs, then naturally you're stressed. So, yeah, John Williamson and that beautiful song was a terrific part of, you know, the 80s, getting people to start becoming aware of how serious the plight of the koala has become. I just feel so frustrated sometimes, Michael, that, you know, you read documents from 1918, 1928, 1936, all these songs. The Australian people are ready to protect the koala. Why can't we do it?
Well, one of the great qualities of the koala is its capacity for reproduction, which ironically is part of today's problem, which I guess, you know, we were hearing earlier about the issue before the Senate. On Raymond Island, East Gippsland, in East Gippsland, which is in Victoria, koalas are just too fertile. There are about 300 koalas on a small island, and the wildlife manager Charlie Franken, who's from the Victorian Department of Sustainability and Environment, says that's about 250 too many. Well, the solution? Vasectomies for males and birth control implants for girls. Sale reporter, sales in Gippsland in Victoria, Kath McAloon, saw exactly what is involved. And Melbourne Zoo vet Jay Patterson explains the process, and I should just warn gentlemen that you might find this a little bit confronting.
What we've got here in my hands, I've got the vas deferens, which is where the sperm travel up from the testicle, and I've just separated it away from the muscle, and what we're going to do is just chop the end off it, and then we just tie a knot in it, and it's as simple as that. Come on, there we go. So we chop the excess off, and then we'll pop that back in and do the same on the other side.
So that's quite a quick procedure.
It is relatively quick, and there's not a lot of trauma to the tissue, and there's not much bleeding at all, which is good for the koala, and it means we get them awake quite quickly as well.
And when he does wake up, will there be pain? Will he know what's happened?
We do give them an injection once they're asleep of a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, which will give them 24 hours pain relief. The other thing that we do is before we start prepping this area, I put a little bit of local anaesthetic just over where I'm going to make the incision, and that will act for about 6 to 8 hours and give him complete pain relief. So the answer is he should not be uncomfortable or in pain from the procedure. He'll feel a bit groggy from the anaesthetic, but that's about it.
My name's Grant Cusiff. I'm a vet from Main Street Vet Clinic in Bairnsdale.
Grant, this one that we've got here, she's a female?
Yes, she is. She's a... we grade her as a grade 5 female. She's mature female.
And what are you going to be doing to her now?
We're going to sterilise her by placing a subcutaneous progesterone implant in her back, which will stop her cycling. She is actually, she's got a pouch young at the moment, so she'll still rear the baby that she's got, but it will stop her cycling in future, so therefore she won't get pregnant.
So the baby that she has at the moment, how far off is that?
We will be able to. I haven't actually assessed it yet. What we do is we'll actually measure its head length, which will give us an indication of how far it will be before it will be independent. But it's still got quite a way to go. You can just see,
see
its little head out there now.
So cute. So we're just measuring the little baby's head.
So, yes, just measuring its nose to crown length gives us an indication of its age. This one is about 42 mil. Now, not being a fed income koala expert, I can't tell you exactly how old that is, but that will be collated with all of the other information that we collect.
You mentioned that you're not a koala expert, you work in a normal everyday vet practice. Is this a bit of a different exercise to be involved in?
It is. It is quite different, but yes, it's very interesting. We do deal with quite a lot of wild animals anyway. It's generally more fire brigade work, you know, as in we see animals that have been acutely injured, whether it's been hit by a car or attacked by dogs or whatever. So this situation, it's actually quite novel and quite good.
I'll let you get on with this one.
Thank you.
Time.
No problems at all.
Dr. Grant Cusiff there, who's from the Main Street Vet Clinic in Bairnsdale in Victoria. And also there we heard from Melbourne Zoo vet Dr. Jay Patterson. She was the female there. That story brought to us by Kath McAloon. And this is Bush Telegraph on ABC Radio National Summer. And we're celebrating the koala. Now, also with us is Deb Tabbart, who's been with us right through the show, and Anne Moyle, who's the author of Koala, a Historical Biography. Deb, this question about managing koala fertility and the fact that some koala populations seem to be, in fact, sort of too virile, I guess. How do you see that issue playing out?
On advice from Professor Hugh Possingham from University of Queensland, when we nominated the koala population for vulnerable under EPBC Act, we ignored those islands because they are just management problems that came from the times of the fur trade. And listen to the numbers, 250, Michael. This isn't, you know, millions of koalas lurking. And the Victorian government has been very good in its public relations to make it sound like koalas are coming out their, you know, their ears and everything's okay. But I would put it to you that one of the reasons the Victorian government doesn't want the koala listed is because of the logging that occurs. And we did actually have a logging group in the Senate sort of saying, you know, logging's good for koalas. And I can assure you the groan from the gallery was pretty loud. So 250 koalas that are being sterilised on an island that shouldn't have them in the first place is not a reason to not list the koalas. And we have constantly, and again from the United States government listed the koala and determined that just because you've got a few or lots of in Little Islands actually says you've really got a problem. So I noticed Senator Brown asked the head of the Australian government environment branch to reread that document. So in Victoria, I will certainly be making it clear that having 250 koalas sterilised isn't a good reason to not list.
And Moyle, this news found delight we take in koalas. How do you think it's developed since the 30s when those children's books came out? What are the other stages in the development of this?
Well, the tourist industry, of course, it's a billion-dollar tourist industry, and it's particularly an adored animal for the Japanese who flock to see it. The worrying thing about that is when there's talk of sterilisation and also on the one hand and inseminating koalas on the other and for diversity, that rather suggests that what may be being thought of is that they will survive as animals in sanctuaries and zoos, which I suppose where most tourists see them. But I think that Deb is very accurate in all she says, because she's been with them for so long. But there is no doubt that there's this enormous feeling that grew up from the 30s and on of a great love for these animals. The love for, they have this appearance, which you were talking about, is rather resembling humans, quite unlike other animals. They have eyes looking straight out, they have a flat nose, and they have hands, which I learnt with great interest, that the koala is the only animal, apart from a human, who has markings, who has fingerprints. There's something that aligns our great affection for the koala with its appearance, that it's looking at us frontally and it's looking at us deeply and wistfully. And the more people have to do with them, the more they love them. I think some organisations feel that tourists shouldn't be allowed to handle them, but I know that Deb believes that hugging and handling a koala will create a bond which lasts with you always. I think what's really worrying is the tendency of wildlife managers, and they're all focused in the States mainly, and they're working on it from slightly different management schemes. They tot up their totals of koalas that are that are alive, and they're often abundant on an island, and they get a picture of the amount of koalas, therefore, which is misleading. It's the scattering in small areas, the bushfires that are coming through and wiping them out, the difficulties yes. of maintaining in southeast places like southeast Queensland and in New South Wales. They were very rare in South Australia, so they were transported in. There's been an awful lot of movement around, which is it makes it difficult. Sometimes you don't see the koala for the bureaucratic trees.
No, that's true.
And actually, it's very worrying.
And it's a long time since I've actually seen a koala in the wild. We're just running out of time here. Deb, you are comfortable with people handling koalas, are you?
Oh, look, you know, as I said to a film crew just recently, I'm concerned about koalas that are being killed in the bush. I think, you know, the ones living in captivity are living in luxury. So, yes, Michael, I know you're running out of time, but I just want the Australian people who are listening to this, the koala has to be listed. That's the next thing that must happen if we are ever going to get this animal back on its feet.
Deborah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Michael.
And thanks to you too, Anne.
Thank you.
Deborah Tabart there, who is CEO of the Australian Koala Foundation, and Anne Moyle, who is a historian whose latest book, The Koala, is published by CSIRO, and it's a lovely book indeed. And let's let the koala have the final word. And that's the program for today. Hope you've enjoyed listening to our Bush Telegraph Radio National Summer Special on koalas. And, of course, you'll find audio and details at the usual spot, abc.net.au/rn/bushtelegraph. That's, of course, where you can contact us. And you can hear the program a little later on today and share your thoughts about it with the whole wide world if you pop onto Facebook or onto Twitter. And tomorrow we'll roll up another iconic animal, the dingo. Now, you'd have to say the dingo holds a pretty ambiguous place in Australian culture. To some people, he's a cunning pest. To others, he is part of our national heritage. And we're going to meet a marvellous woman. Her name's Taree Gordon, and she runs a place called the Jirralinga Dingo Conservation Centre, which is in central Victoria. Over the past 6 years, she and her husband have transformed the grounds of this place, making it into a wonderful environment to breed dingoes. And I went there, interviewed her, and met some of the dingoes, and we'll find out all about that. And a particular highlight of this is Therese's recollection of the time she participated in a dingo ritual of mourning a dead dog. It's an extraordinary story. Coming up now on ABC Radio National Summer, it's news time. I'm Michael Cathcart. Toodaloo.